well. Baggy trousers, cuffs, double-breasted, everything that in England had sort of gone out of fashion and style so long ago. And it was quaint. It was really quaint. And somehow it was rather nice. It was sort of reassuring that Australia still had some catching up to do. You know, it hadn't got to this sort of, how would I explain it? I mean, it's almost sort of over the top social position that England had got it into, and which was clearly going to take England, you know, down a very questionable path in terms of its prosperity and things like that. And I found Australians extremely friendly. I really did. I was quite surprised. And these broad Aussie accents, I mean, these accents were just sort of, well, obviously coming at you from all over the place. But it was, and Sydney, I mean, Sydney was, you know, it was a city, and compared to, I never liked cities in England at all, really. I mean, London was, I found, always too big. Birmingham was too dirty, too industrial, and Huddersfield was absolutely foul. It was just filthy, you know, but hence the saying, where there's muck, there's brass, lad, you know. But Sydney, I mean, it had an openness about itself, which was totally unique to me. I hadn't experienced before. I mean, this beautiful harbour. I didn't have much of a chance to look around it, but I did have a bit of a look. And in that brief sort of glimpse, it just seemed that that here was a city that really sort of had its feet on the ground, knew where it was going. And yeah, so in the few hours that I'd had waiting to get on the train, that was a sort of an impression. And then it was on the train. Trains were a big disappointment. God, they were hopeless. So slow. So slow. And it would have been the Southern Aurora that I would have been on. I wouldn't have known that at the time. But again, I had no appreciation. I thought it was so slow. It probably actually was quite reasonable. But I had no real appreciation of distance. And even travelling from Sydney to Wagga, well, you know, you drive it today, it's a six-hour drive. So it's a long way. And I suppose if you were doing that in England, you'd be virtually going from London to Huddersfield, or more. But the train, and I was trying to think about it the other day. I can't remember whether it was an overnight trip. I've got a feeling it must have been. But in any event, we got to Wagga, got off at Wagga, I would say, you know, mid-afternoon, two o'clock-ish or something like that. And you asked me whether the Apex Club was there to meet me. No. A guy that was there to meet me was the, if you like, the Stewart's Farm manager. And I got off the train onto the platform at Wagga. I had my bag and I pulled the green trunk out of the baggage compartment. And I was standing there, and most other people had got off or drifted off. And this tall guy, tall, lanky bloke with a broad brim hat came wandering over, and he cocked his head up at me, and he'd lost the left eye. All that was there was the white of the eyeballs. And he sort of cocked his head up and he just said, "You'd be the Pom." And I said, "Yeah, I think I'm probably the one you're looking for, you know." And he said, "Well, grab your bag," and he didn't help. I'm dragging this damn trunk, and we got out of the station, and there to greet me was a photographer from the Wagga Daily Advertiser newspaper. I was something of a novelty because I was this Pommy migrant coming to live in the Wagga district, and they took a photograph and just did a little blockline story in the next day's paper, saying, you know, that this guy had arrived and he'd been sponsored by the Apex Club of Wagga. Which I sort of thought, gee, this is interesting if they think that's news. But anyway, I heaved this trunk into the back of the ute, an old Holden ute with the three gears on the steering column, And we got in there, and this old guy, and I can't remember his name. I know he's dead now, and he was a delightful bloke. I keep thinking it was Archie, but I don't think it was. But for the time being, I'll call him Archie. Anyway, he sat there and he started the car up and he said, "Do you like a beer?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, I don't mind a beer." And he slipped her into second, and we just dribbled down this bit of dirt road, round a corner, for all of about 50 yards and stopped. And there we were outside the Railway Hotel, which is still standing in Wagga. I took a photograph of it a few months ago, coincidentally. It's empty now, it's an empty building, but it's still the Railway Hotel. Now, Archie had obviously been in there before the train arrived, mm-hmm. because he had a couple of his mates there. It was only a small bar. And he wanders in, and there's two other guys in there, and he wanders in front of me, and I said, "I've found the pom," and wanders up to the bar and said, "Well, what do you want?" So I said, "Oh, I'll have a beer." And he said, "Yeah, well, what sort of beer, you know?" And I mean, you know, being a pom and coming from England, I said, "Oh, just a pint." And he said, "Right, okay, give him a pint." So they poured me a pint, and I took a swig of it, and I noticed that his glass was extremely small. I didn't think much about it, and he didn't touch it, and I was swigging away, and we were having a bit of a yarn about nothing in particular, and I'd probably got about a quarter of the way into this pint of beer, and Archie picks up his little glass, and it was one of those little ponies, 5 ounces, and he just went bang, and it was gone in a flash, and he just put the glass down and said, "Your shout," and I thought, "What on earth is this? I've never heard of the expression shout before." Anyway, that was my introduction to Australian beer drinking habits, and I learnt very fast. I didn't drink pints after that again either. But no, it was great. And then we started the drive out to the farm. Well, it was dirt road all the way in those days, 20 miles, not that far. But it was getting late afternoon, early sunset or dimming sun. Gloaming sun, you call it, or something, I think. But at that beautiful time of the day. And the thing that absolutely struck me were these rosellas. I'd never seen a bird like that in my life. And I couldn't get over it. And they were flitting in front of the car, or things like that. Just absolutely magnificent, you know. And that's sort of something that very definitely helped me. I don't know. I took to Australia like a duck to water, and that's one reason why. I don't know. I don't know why, but I have the love of animals and things. But those birds, they just blew me away. Just blew me away.
In that initial period, we're just talking about a couple of days, aren't we? Now, is it 3 days?
Yeah, about 3 days.
Did Australia meet your expectations? Like, were you expecting it to be the way you actually found it?
Well, I think I probably hadn't worked out what my expectations were, or whether it had met my expectations by that stage. I'd found that, as I said, it seemed to be certainly behind the times in terms of Britain, at least in Sydney. Now, in terms of the country town, well, I'd barely sort of seen the town of Wagga at that point. I went straight out to the farm. And the Stuarts were wonderful people. They said, "Look, the problem we've got is that we're in the middle of a shocking drought. So we can feed you, we can clothe you, you can stay here as long as you like. If you want to go try and pursue a life on the land, we'll help you to the extent we can. We'll teach you what we can, but we can't pay you any money. There's just no, just can't be done." They were, as I say, they were wonderful. It very quickly became clear that, you know, you couldn't live without money. I'd have to move into town and get another job. But the one thing that I suppose the next thing that really hit me was was after the first night there, getting woken up at about 6 a.m, again by Archie, for breakfast. And here he had this big electric fry pan full of chops, bacon, eggs, tomatoes. This was meat to die for, basically. And I mean, you never had that much meat available in England. I have vague recollections still of rationing as it applied in England as late as 1955. We'd been as a family of four, rationed to a quarter of a pound of butter a week, one pint of milk a day, pretty strict rationing. And here's all this meat all of a sudden, but not just that was breakfast. Then came lunch, and there were more chops. And then came dinner. There was a roast, a leg of lamb. And this went on day in and day out. And I mean, it was just unbelievable. It was brilliant. It's just unbelievable. I couldn't get my head around the availability of so much food. But I didn't stay there for long, no, because it unfortunately wasn't going to work. So I moved into town. I had in the meantime gone to an Apex Club meeting, mind you.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I'd done, that would say the right thing, the Apex, local president of the Apex Club, got in touch with me and said, we've got a meeting, come say good day. And I did, and it was just a meeting. I went to that and introduced myself to them, and we all had a bit of a yarn, and nothing too sort of memorable. I think I probably went to a couple of other meetings subsequent to that, and then it probably faded by the board. But I moved into town, and I shared a flat above a hotel, the Exchange Hotel. We had a flat with another Aussie, a guy called Williams, who subsequently became my best man, and two Kiwis. And we really got on well, and they made me so welcome. They were good. They ribbed the crap out of me, oh, you pommy bastard this and pommy bastard that, as did everybody else in Wagga. This is what I sort of discovered very quickly, that if all this sort of ribbing was basically good-natured, but it was also a test to see how you responded. And if you responded by giving it back about as well as you were receiving it, they loved you. Mm-hmm. They loved you. But if your hackles got up, or you got sour and you sulked and you didn't like it, they would see that they got under your skin, and they'd just keep riling and riling and riling. I learned very quickly that Australians have got a tremendously good sense of humour. Very much like the British sense of humour, I think. But they love to take the piss out of people. They love to see how they're going to react. And if they react badly, they'll take it out all the worse. And somehow, this just appealed to me. This just appealed to me. I don't know why, but I really started to... That's when I took to Australia like duck to water. I really started to feel deep affection for the people of Australia and for the country. And I got used to, once I was living in Wagga, I still found the towns, or the Wagga, for instance, more like an American town than an English town, particularly the main street, because you had the awnings and things like that. Not that I'd ever been to America, but what you'd seen in the movies and things like that was more akin to an American design than it was to an English design. Wagga was a very prosperous and thriving town, and I know that at the time I was there, there were 21 pubs in the main street. There aren't that many pubs there now, but the four of us would start off with a middy at the Exchange on a Friday night, and we'd go around and end up at the Exchange having done all 21 pubs, and we wouldn't end up in good shape. The Exchange was interesting because it was the classic sort of Australian pub of the time, where everything was bolted down. little round tables that were bolted down, stools around that were bolted down, green tiles up to about shoulder height at the bar. And after the place closed each night, the barman just got a 2-inch hose and just hosed her out, just hosed it out. And, you know, it'd all fly out into the gutter in the street. The pubs in Wagga were still, when I first got there, although it had formally been abolished, but they were still running to the 6 o'clock swill. And the swill, the 6 o'clock swill sort of ended progressively according to various council, local council things, I think. But, oh dear, that was an eye-opener. Mm. That was an absolute eye-opener. You know, guys had come into that bar from 5 o'clock, basically, after they finished work, and they'd start off on a few middies. And as she got a bit closer to six, they started ordering jugs, and they were drinking out of jugs. And then, you know, 6 o'clock had come round, and usually the barman say, right, you got 5 minutes for last orders. This bloke, the barman, he says, come on, you buggers, you got 5 minutes left for your last orders, you know, get it in here. And they down and come the jugs. So people were pouring the stuff into them, and, I mean, they were being sick all over the floor and everything else. It was totally uncivilised. Totally uncivilised, particularly compared to the sort of genteel atmosphere of a country pub in England, where ladies were welcome and all the rest of it. This was just a men's, you know, binge swill hall, basically.
What was the rest of the, with the English country pub, like ladies are welcome, and you said, and the rest of it?
The sort of classic English pub, I suppose, had atmosphere about it. You know, it might be an ancient old building, 200-400 years old, with big oak beams in it, a big open fireplace, horse brasses down the walls, bits of pottery here and there, hunting horns, you know, this sort of stuff. And of course, you know, the very genteel English pint of beer, you know, there, sir. And it was all very peaceful and very quiet and very civilised. And of course, their opening hours were quaint too, you know. They were open from, 12 till 2, and then they closed for the afternoon and opened up at about 5 and stayed open till about 10. Okay. As I say, very, very genteel sort of pubs, and even the city pubs in England were similar to that. You know, you had little sort of dog box areas where you could have a private conversation and things like that, and you could get your pork pie for lunch or a ploughman's lunch or what have you. Whereas, I mean, here, they might flog you a meat pie, but there was nothing to make the session at the pub enjoyable other than the fact that you bought beer and you drank it, and that was about it. But the 6 o'clock swill was an experience, and it didn't last long. I literally caught probably only the last few weeks of it, and then they changed, so the pubs closed at 10, which was a move in the right direction. The other quaint thing about drinking habits, of course, is that on a Sunday, you had to be a bona fide traveller to get a drink. So we couldn't have a drink anywhere in Wagga, because we lived there, and you had to be 20 miles away from town to get a drink, and you had to sign a visitor's book. So, group of us, I suppose, by then, I don't know, about 10, 15 of us, quite good mates from around various traps in Wagga, we'd all get together, we'd drive out to the Rock, to the pub at the Rock, sign the visitor's book so that we could have a few beers on a Sunday, and then turn around and drive back, which is all somewhat quaint when you think about the fact that you're not supposed to drink and drive. in this society, in those days, you were encouraged to drink and drive. And again, you know, another one of those quirky things about Australia that I just found so enjoyable.
What I've seen on documentaries and films, it seemed to be sawdust, if I remember that correctly,
on the pubs. Yeah, some of them did, yeah.
What was that?
Oh, I suppose to absorb the slops more than anything else. I don't remember it in the exchange, actually. This guy was very keen on, because he didn't need it. Everything was tiles. and he had a 2-inch hose. I vividly remember that. It was, and it had some power in it too, you know, and it was just like putting out a fire. He just hosed the joint down and shut the door.
Now, you mentioned that you were sharing accommodation above one of the pubs. How were you earning an income?
Yeah, well, when I came into town, because as you say, I realised that I'd have to get a job. Well, I got a job at a place called Maples, which was a furniture shop in Wagga. And having worked in a furniture shop in Solihull in England, you know, I just wandered in there, and I think that was probably my first port of call, and, you know, explained who I was and what I'd done vis-a-vis selling furniture, and they gave me a job, no problem. I got a job there. Didn't enjoy it very much, because it sort of was a bit boring, I think. And I wasn't there very long, which was probably a mistake. I left, you know, without having anything else lined up to do. So that was a mistake. And I ended up working on a couple of building sites, and then I ended up on a steel foundry, or a steelworks, on the way between Wagga and Forest Hill, painting star posts, you know, fence posts, steel fence posts, and painting them with this tar-based epoxy paint. And that was a shocking job. I mean, this paint would get all over your jeans and everything else, and, take your trousers off at night, they'd virtually stand up on their own because they're just coated in the stuff. And I did that for a while. And things were getting a bit sort of grim in some respects, because I wasn't enjoying that work. I also did a brief week's work on a picking asparagus out at Gundagai. You could go to the employment office, and in these days it wasn't a matter of registering for the dole as much as going to an employment office and seeing what jobs they had available, and they'd say, right, okay, you can go and pick asparagus at Gundagai. Here's a letter of introduction, and if you didn't go, well, you didn't get any dole. I never applied for the dole in my life, and I never received any, and I never applied for any. But the employment office you went to find out where there was work available. But I met in Romano's Hotel in Wagga one Friday evening, totally by accident, a journo on the Wagga Advertiser. And well, we were just talking casually about nothing in particular. And I spent the weekend thinking to myself, by gee, this guy's got an interesting life, being a journalist. And the only thing that I'd been remotely good at school was writing. I didn't know how well or otherwise I could write, but I had enjoyed it. I quite enjoyed doing essays and things like that. Anyway, on the Monday, I thought, well, there's only one thing to do here, and that's to go and find out, you know. So I went along to the Wagga Advertiser office, and I asked if I could see the managing editor, who was a bloke called Gordon Jackson, who was quite an intimidating sort of person, a personality, as it turned out. And I had no appointment or anything like that, but he agreed to see me. Sat me down, said, what do you want? You know, and I said, well, I think I'd like to be a journalist. He said, well, what do you mean, you think? And I said, well, I met one of your journalists the other night, and I think he's got a fascinating life, and I think it might be suited to me. And we had a bit more of a talk, and he wanted to know what my qualifications were, and all I had really was what I'd left school with, which meant virtually nothing to him, of course. Anyway, at the end of this, he said, I don't know if I'm going soft or if I had a bad night last night or I've had a bad day today, but I'll give you a job, I'll give you a try. And he said, you can start next Monday. You'll get paid $23 a week, which means you'll get $19 in your pocket. You'll wear a coat and tie to work every day. You'll have clean shoes and you'll have a decent haircut. Now get out. And so I became a cadet journalist, a first year cadet journalist on the Wagga Advertiser. And yes, I did enjoy it. But in those days, I mean, journalism wasn't a university course or anything in those days. It was a four-year, well, basically a four-year cadetship training on the job sort of situation. The first thing I did was, initially, was to get cups of coffee for senior staff who wanted a cup of coffee, you know, and the subs and things like that. Then you graduated to writing a block line under a photograph to go with something, you know, and it might be two lines. And when you see your first two lines in print, you think, oh, gee, that's good. Then you might get a little bit to do here and there, a bit of a rewrite of some press release or something, see how well you sew it down. And you've got a senior journo saying, no, that's no good, you know, this is the way to do it. And no, you've put the lead down at the bottom there, and you've got to bring the lead up here. Or no, this is far too long. And yeah, you get knocked into shape pretty quickly. And the subbies knock you into shape a bit further. And gradually you get used to it, I suppose. The other thing you're supposed to do is do a tech, a TAFE course or tech college course on shorthand. I hated shorthand, absolutely hated it, because I just couldn't get my head around it. I couldn't do it. So I used the excuse, basically, that I write left-handed. So I used that as an excuse in my own mind as much as anything else to say, well, I couldn't do shorthand because the thick strokes always turned out to be thin and the thin ones turned out to be thick. That was my story anyway. I ended up doing my own sort of, or developing my own sort of bastardised short stroke longhand, which did me reasonably well, but was dangerous when it came to the need to quote very accurately, particularly on the court rounds. And you know, you on a country paper, you get thrown into all sorts of things pretty quickly, you know, and some of it's boring, some of it's good, some of it you understand, some of it you don't. Local council stuff, court stuff, anyway, I stuck at that. The guy was at the Advertiser, would have been from May, June of 66, through, I was probably there, I was certainly there over 12 months, and I thought by then, at that stage, which is what everybody did in the industry in those days, you tried to truncate your cadetship by either getting a promotion on in the same organisation or whatever. So I went to the editor and said, look, I think I'm worthy of a fourth year cadetship. And he said, well, I don't. Get out. No, I thought, oh, well, the only other way to do it then is to apply for a job somewhere else, which I did. And I got a D grade on what was then called Australian United Press, which is now owned by Australian Associated Press, but it was a wire service which produced material for regional papers in Australia. And it would take the Reuters stuff, and it would take Associated Press of America stuff, and it would take stuff from its own reporters in Australia and send out, it was a wire service, as I say, sent out on the wires to newspapers like the Advertiser and other regional newspapers, a sort of compendium of domestic and international news, which those regional papers, they'd subscribe to this service and then they could publish. Well, I got this job with AUP in Canberra, and I was in the press gallery, three of us on staff. A guy called Ken Broderick was the head of the bureau. A bloke called Ken Begg had just come back from London, and he was the next bloke, and then I was the new chum and the junior journo. Well, it was a disaster from a number of points of view, not the least of which being I had never been in a parliament before in my life. I knew nothing about politics. I knew nothing about the workings of parliament, and I wasn't interested. I wasn't interested. And here I was stuck in Parliament House in the press gallery in Canberra, day in, day out, having to cover politics. So it wasn't going to work. I was too young. I was too naive. I was just too young for politics at that stage. And My biggest recollection, though, is McEwen. So, I mean, as a junior journo, I didn't really get to, you know, to interview ministers and things like that. But I remember coming down the press gallery steps one day and onto the government side of the House of Reps, and there, wandering down the corridor, was McEwen, looking very grim and dour, and sort of hobbling as he tended to do because his feet got very painful. And you know, I just hit the wall. I said, "You just hit the wall, morning, sir." And he wandered past and just went, "It's this grunt." But there were a number of other reasons that sort of require a bit of backtracking, I suppose, that led to, again, my making the stupid mistake of leaving a job when I had no other one to go to. And that is that when I was with the Advertiser, they put out an annual supplement called Riverina Unlimited, which covered the circulation area of the Advertiser newspaper. And they assigned journos to particular areas of the circulation. And I got sent off to Tumut to find a bit of a story to put into this supplement. And one of the things that was happening there was that the Blowering Dam at Tumut was completing, and you know, it was all about to be opened. So the end of the snowy scheme per se. And while I was there, I met a musical group called The Settlers, which was a bloke called Ulico Boyle and his wife Anne. And Ulick, of course, was Irish with a name like that. His wife Anne, and a pom called Peter Barry. And the three of them, they all worked on the snow scheme, or Ulick and Peter did. Ulick was in the first aid, he was a first aid man there. He had been a construction worker, a blaster, a powder monkey, blasting. And Peter Barry was a dozer driver. And they'd written an album and recorded an album of songs on the construction days of the Snowy Mountain Scheme, which had been recorded in 1966 on the RCA label. And anyway, I met these guys and I did a bit of a story for them as well, as a bit of a colour piece, you know. We went into the Tumut Star Hotel and we drank fairly substantial quantities of booze and, you know, struck up a bit of a sing-song. And by this stage, I had actually learnt my nine chords. And I sang a few Johnny Cash songs, and we had a generally good night. And that was that. So I went away, and that was that. Now, if I fast track forward to 1967, when I'm in the press gallery with the AUP and hating every minute of it, out of the blue, I get this telephone call from Ulico Boyle. "Paul," he said, "we're making another record. Now, Peter Barry, he's buggered off. He's gone to, he went up to Hong Kong, in fact, to open an Australian hamburger joint in Hong Kong. He'd gone. So, Paul, we want you to sing on the next album." You know, well, I thought, this is fantastic, you know. We're all moving to Sydney, because they'd been living in Tumut. They were going up to Sydney too. And sure enough, we went up to Sydney and we made this second album, More Songs of the Snowy Mountains. And it was quite good. It was well recorded. George Goller, who's probably one of Australia's, if not Australia's, finest jazz guitarists these days, he was in those days the session guitarist at RCA on the RCA label, and he did a lot of the backing guitar work, and it all came up. It was great fun to do, a lot of fun. You know, made you feel famous. Thought you'd hit the big time. This was wonderful. So we were going to. We were going to get onto the club circuit in Sydney, but so I left AUP, drove out of Canberra. I at that stage had a beaten up Ford Cortina, and as I drove up Northbourne Avenue and going out of Canberra, I sort of went, "Whoopee! I'll never see this place again. I'm never coming back here." Incidentally, I had a flat in Curtin when I came to Canberra, just near the Curtin shops. And the big topic of conversation at that time was that they were building the hospital, Woden Valley Hospital.
Oh, yes.
And everybody, the big question on everyone's lips was, why would anybody build a hospital so far out of town? Mm. You look at it today, it's almost in the centre of town. But I mean, Curtin was virtually the end of the line, and Woden Valley Hospital was well beyond the end of the line, you know, as far as Canberra was concerned. It was very much a sort of a village, if you like. It was a quaint place. I subsequently spent 13 years here, and I love the place. But before I get on to that, I mean, in those days, I didn't have many friends. It was a single room unit flat. I was in a strange place. The guys in the gallery were great, and that was all fine, the people I worked with, but I didn't like the work. So this opportunity came along. I thought, you cracker, this is it. I'm going off to be famous. Much more fun to be famous. Well, of course, the thing we didn't count on was that the clubs at the time were only interested in hard rock.
Mm.
Because, again, this was the Beatles, Jerry and the Pacemakers, you name it, you know, I mean, all of this. It was hard rock music. They didn't want a group of people singing folk music at all. So it was a disaster. But I suppose things have silver linings. One thing we did get was a gig on the Reg Grundy Channel 9 television programme called I've Got a Secret, which was a pretty shocking piece of television, very low budget, where you had a panel of people, one of whom I remember was Stuart Wagstaff, and you'd go on there and you sit down and the